Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of June 25th, 2018. On this week's show, Ken Early of the Irish Times joins us to talk about World Cup matters, including whether this is the year for England, whether this is another year for Germany, maybe, and whether it will ever be the year for Argentina.
It will again.
The Ringer's Ben Lindbergh will also chat with us about baseball's devious plots to add more teams and more playoff teams and make the designated hitter a universal thing. And Jay Caspian Kang will explain why it's time to kill the NBA draft and replace it with something better. Joining me in Slate's Washington, D.C. studio this week is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic, and the cult minor league baseball classic, Wild and Outside. Hello, Stefan.
Hi, Josh.
That was an instruction from Remy is the Man, the username from somebody who reviewed us on iTunes, who describes him or herself as a first-time reviewer, long-time listener, and was wondering why the cult minor league baseball classic, Wild and Outside, does not get pub. We give it pub sometimes.
Occasionally. And we've discussed why before. So Remy, go back, listen to every episode. We can't remember when it was, but we talked about why. I don't include that in my little bio line.
The cult minor league baseball classic, Wild and Outside.
I like that part, the cult.
How about we start talking about the World Cup? Just get right into it. Let's be good hosts and invite our guest in right away. Joining us from a media center in central Moscow, it is Ken Early. He writes about soccer for the Irish Times and occasionally for Slate. He is also one of the hosts of the Second Captains podcast. You've been to many a World Cup, and you've been traveling around Russia to go to games. I think you've been to 6 games so far. How has the experience been, sort of the in-stadium experience, and how has the country been as a host, and how do people feel about the World Cup being there?
I think it's been really great so far. If you're talking about the in-stadium experience, it's pretty much indistinguishable from every other World Cup. I mean, it's a very kind of homogenized experience. It's the FIFA World Cup experience, and it's pretty much the same. It doesn't really matter where you are. It's only the weather that changes. In terms of the country, I mean, people are clearly really excited about it. Really happy to have all these foreigners here. I mean, I've just come today from Nizhny Novgorod, which is a city to the east of Moscow, which formerly was closed to all foreigners. It was like a place where I think they did a lot of high-level military stuff during the Cold War, and they didn't want any foreigners walking around. I don't think still that it's a place that will attract masses of tourists from abroad. So I think just the to see their streets packed with people from England and people from Panama really made people happy. Actually, there was one thing that I saw on the metro from the game yesterday. After the game, a bunch of England fans got on the train and started singing one of their sort of tournament songs, All the Way, We're Going All the Way. And then when they finished that, they suddenly burst into a chant of Russia, Russia, you know, for and what was amazing was just looking around, seeing the faces of the Russians lighting up with delight.
England still has plenty of time for its hearts to be broken and for that song to be proven what it's been proven year after year in World Cup after World Cup since 1966. But they played pretty well against weak opposition in the first 2 games. You went to both of those, obviously, Ken, and you wrote a piece that we'll be posting on Slate after we are done with this conversation. Is this really a different English model for how to create a World Cup team, and is it one that might actually succeed on in this tournament?
It depends what you mean by succeed in the tournament. If you mean win the tournament, then no. I can't guarantee that England won't win the World Cup. I would be amazed I would be astonished if they did. But, you know, they're a pretty decent team. Is it a new English model? Not, I think, by design. I think this is something that happens with English football without the establishment of English football really noticing or directing the process. It's something that's happened from the bottom up. English football isn't really quite so English anymore.
Right.
It's a lot more open to foreign influence than it has been. And I think this has to do with foreign influence in the league, you know, foreign players and coaches coming to play in the Premier League, of which now, as Gareth Southgate always says, we only have 33% of the players in the league. But it also has to do with the world in which the more globalized world in which these players have grown up.
The game of the tournament thus far was contested by Sweden and then the team that's going to eventually beat England on penalties later in this World Cup, Germany. And it was the kind of tension that you rarely see in the second group stage game of a World Cup, that Germany were either going to go out if they lost to Sweden, or if it was a draw, they were going to be in a pretty precarious situation. And then the strike by Toni Kroos, right, could have been the last kick of the game, potentially, to give Germany the win, was just totally thrilling. What do you make of this Germany team? Is this a thing, Ken, where we're going to look back at this and they're going to like overcome early obstacles and it will just be the Germany we know and maybe love?
Well, I think it's still a little too early to say, because we have to see if Germany are going to turn up against South Korea, because they didn't start too well against Sweden, and they really were torn to pieces by Mexico. I think I can see South Korea taking very much the Mexican approach to playing against Germany, which is to sit deep and hit them in the counterattack. And the difference between South Korea and Sweden is that South Korea do have real speed in attack, with Son particularly, who's really, really dangerous and a really pacey player. So you could see Germany being vulnerable to some of the same tactics that Mexico used against South Korea. There does, you know, I mean, I went to all but one of Germany's matches in the 2014 World Cup when they went all the way to the final and won. They are nothing like that team. The team that we have now is nothing like as good. I mean, that team not only had, you know, I mean, there's a couple of players like Philipp Lahm and Bastian Schweinsteiger, most notably, who are now retired, who this team is missing. Manuel Neuer, the goalkeeper, hadn't just come off a season where he was injured. He was in much better form. But really, they had just a kind of a collective purpose about them, which I haven't seen from this team yet.
Argentina would be the other team that looks really bad, that we would have been expecting to make it to another final. Messi looks underserviced. He's alone out there. Their defense looks shoddy. They're in last place in their group, and there's a much better chance that Argentina won't get out of the group than Germany at this point.
Well, the Argentina story is the most amazing operatic saga of the World Cup. How could they be so awful? How could they be so appallingly terrible as they were against Croatia? How could the manager get things so wrong? How could so many players play so badly? How could Lionel Messi be so apparently overcome by, crumbling under the pressure of having to lead such a terrible team towards what he clearly can't persuade himself is anything other than
a complete team.
Total doom. Exactly. He doesn't seem to be able to make himself believe that Argentina is capable of any better. And he certainly doesn't seem to be transmitting any confidence or energy to his teammates. In fact, it seems very much the opposite, as though he's a figure who inhibits them, as though they feel, you know, they're almost embarrassed to be sharing the pitch with this historic talent. I mean, the coach, Sampaoli, said this. It's one of the most amazing things I've ever heard a manager say. You know, the reality of the Argentina squad, you know, obscures Messi's talent. You know, people saying, oh, you know, Messi should have done more, should have helped us out more. And he said, look, our players are so bad that, like, it's very difficult for him to look good. This is the manager of the team speaking. Yeah, when have you ever, you don't, that is not a normal situation. That's a really, really pathological situation.
Well, the players have said they want the manager not to coach them in the third game of the group. That's Probably not a good sign.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, so there's all this stuff coming out of the Argentina camp, which, you know, rumors of punch-ups, you know, Mascherano supposedly involved in a punch-up with another player. He said he didn't, although everyone was saying, well, why have you got a black eye then? I suppose it is the kind of thing that can happen in training. Leaked audio recordings. Diego Simeone, the Argentinian manager of Atletico Madrid, is, you know, on WhatsApp sending an audio note to his mate, his assistant, Germán Burgos, also Argentinian, in which he dissects the disaster of the team, pins most of the blame on the coach, but then makes some scathing comments about Lionel Messi as well. I mean, when I say scathing, he's not saying this is Messi's fault, but what he said was, which one of them would you pick? I mean, when I say which one, it's which one of Messi or Ronaldo. Be honest, which one of them would you pick for a normal team? And it's clearly going to be Cristiano. What he means by a normal team is, okay, it's fine for Lionel Messi when he plays with Barcelona. We've got this in this really sophisticated environment with great players playing a very evolved system, which is designed to get him the ball in exactly the areas of field where he wants to receive it, in exactly the areas of the field where he can do damage. And take him out of that and put him into a normal sort of a team, or in Argentina's case, a below normal, an abnormally bad team. And suddenly, he doesn't seem to be able to do anything. Whereas Ronaldo, this was the point that Simeone was making, and this isn't just when Simeone says that it has so much more weight than if it's simply a journalist or, you know, someone on Twitter. People are making the same point, but this is Diego Simeone, who is, you know, regarded as one of the outstanding coaches working in Europe at this moment. And he's saying that if I've got a normal team, and I've got the opportunity to choose one of Messi or Ronaldo, there's only one of them I'm going to pick, and it isn't going to be our boy. It's going to be Cristiano, because he can score a goal out of nothing. It doesn't matter what the level is of the game. It doesn't matter. He doesn't seem to need to have great teammates. In fact, unlike Messi, he seems to enjoy... It's an unfair comparison, because Portugal are better than Argentina. They are giving him a better platform on which to perform. But the fact is, he can head in a corner. He can score a free kick. He always seems to be sort of up for it.
This is the fascinating thing about high-level international soccer, is that, like, there's no free agency. I mean, you can do a one-time switch, I suppose, but, like, this is, like, harkens back to the days in sports when you were just, like, stuck. Like, Messi has quit his national team before, but obviously everyone knew at the time that it was just a fit of pique and he would be back. I mean, Mo Salah is talking about how he's unhappy with Egypt, and he was like talking about, maybe I want to walk away. That's not going to happen either. Like, these guys just have to stay with these, like, no matter how fucked up the federation is, no matter how bad the manager is, no matter how crappy their teammates are, they just got to stick it out. And it's fascinating to watch. And it's, like, certainly different than how club soccer works.
Yeah, it's just a little bit more like life, you know, where you're trapped in circumstances, you're a victim of your own fate, and there's nothing that you can struggle as you might. You can't really escape it. I mean, maybe, you know, you mentioned Mo Salah. I think he's going to be even more upset now, because I've just watched Saudi Arabia score the winning goal against Egypt in the last minute of injury time.
Oh, no.
Mohamed Salah earlier scored a goal, and I don't know if you saw the celebration, but there wasn't one. It was one of those where you see where the player used to play for the club that he's just scored against.
Yeah.
Salah scored against Saudi Arabia and essentially didn't react. I understand this story about him being unhappy to the point of thinking about quitting Egypt is true. I mean, Egypt, for some reason, I don't know the exact machinations that led to them choosing Grozny as their training base, but when you're in Grozny and Ramzan Kadyrov, the local strongman and leader, takes an interest in you, you sort of have to turn up for the photo ops.
Yeah.
I understand Salah was granted honorary citizenship. Certainly these photos appeared of him with Kadyrov, and he then was hammered on social media. I'm just looking at him now. He doesn't look too happy. My God, I hope this isn't his last game.
What a horrible World Cup it's been for that guy.
It's just all fallen apart for Salah so horribly since Sergio Ramos put him down in the Champions League final. Everything to that point was just going so well, and then suddenly he hits the ground, shoulder out, and he, the worst thing, he even comes out of this World Cup also with regrets. You know, why didn't he play the first game against Uruguay? Why didn't he even play 15 or 20 minutes? The coach, Hector Cooper, conservative Argentinian coach, not a risk-averse kind of guy, decided that he didn't want to put him in and maybe risk him aggravating the injury. But I think we can see from the way that, oh my God, the referee's just taking a selfie. But no, it's not the referee. It's a man. Sorry, it's a man wearing a top the same color as the referees, but not actually the referee. Salah's trying to go off the field, and a guy comes up to him to get a selfie, and he just said, "Oh God, people need to be a bit more understanding of these players."
Let's end on a happier note. I thought maybe we could just go around and talk about the best thing or our favorite thing that we've seen, and Ken, we can get one from you that you saw in person. But the James Rodriguez pass against Poland just obviously brings back memories of him being, you know, for a lot of the 2014 tournament, the most exciting young player, and that form kind of hasn't been there for him in between the 2014 and 2018 World Cups. But just the ability to see that ball and then execute it was just unbelievable.
And it might be worth setting that up. I mean, he was coming up the left side, and he basically swung a 50-yard ball around three retreating defenders sprinting backwards. It was a thing of beauty.
What's your favorite thing, Stefan?
That might have been it. I really enjoy just the one of the things for the at the World Cup that I most love is watching countries that we don't normally get to see, and watching this sort of enthusiasm build. And part of that is watching the game and sort of appreciating some of the beauty and the excitement. But it's also something that goes on inside your head, like, oh, Senegal, wow. I mean, I know Mane, but I don't know how good they might be. And they play just a lovely, exciting match with Japan on Sunday.
And this is only their second World Cup appearance ever, right?
Ever, yeah. And just those are the sort of moments of you get a rooting interest in a nation and a player that you might not have had otherwise. And that's a terrific group. You've got Colombia, Senegal, and Japan. Two of those three are going to go forward. I love chaos too. So the groups that have that kind of chaos are the ones that sort of get you sticking around to the third match of group play, like the Mexico, Germany, Sweden, South Korea group, and the Argentina, Iceland, Nigeria, Croatia group. So it's those moments that sort of start drawing you into the tournament with more and more passion as each game goes by.
And Ken, what's the best thing that you've seen?
Well, I mean, one that we've already mentioned, the Kroos free kick was just amazing to do that in those circumstances. Stunning. But you know, Cristiano Ronaldo, I was at the game between Portugal and Spain, and to see, and he did something along the same lines as Kroos, you know, to score a hat trick with a free kick from that distance, with a totally different free kick from what he usually takes. He usually tries to kick the ball as hard as he can. This time he chipped it and scored an amazing goal to finish an amazing game. But I also want to mention another game that I went to was Brazil against Costa Rica and St. Petersburg. And I don't think I've laughed as much sitting in the press boxes as at any other game. Well, it did Brazil against Costa Rica with Neymar just having an absolute, I mean, Neymar against the referee, Bjorn Kuipers, who just kept telling him to get up and shut up. I've never seen a match where the referee almost seemed to curse the player as much as the player was cursing the referee.
No, selfie afterwards?
No, I don't think there would have been a selfie. I'm not sure Neymar would have agreed. But the performance of Neymar in the last 20 minutes was one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in terms of just this utter brattishness, this like ridiculous. I mean, this is a 26-year-old man. I mean, the Brazilian players were talking about him afterwards. Oh, the kid, you know, you don't know how much pressure the kids are. So he's 26. You know, he's been the star of Brazil for like 5 years. Come on, we should see a bit more from him. But he was having he was sort of losing the plot. He got booked for descent. He tried to win a penalty with a dive. Then he pulled out a rainbow flick in injury time. I mean, an amazing piece of skill to sort of humiliate the defenders. And scored a goal in the 97th minute. I mean, a goal that didn't really matter. A tap in. Then had a breakdown. Then he knelt on the field, covered his hand, and started, you know, sobbing, shoulders shuddering with sobs. I mean, you can't take your eyes off this guy for a second. I mean, I don't understand. I don't understand what's going on in his head. I don't understand how he can behave in such a stupid way. It's actually set off a big debate in Brazil, where lots of people were saying, Neymar is a disgrace. This is embarrassing for Brazil to see him act in such a petulant, childish and dishonest way, trying to cheat all the time. It shames us in Brazil. And then other Brazilians saying, for instance, I saw Juninho Pernambucano, who was a great player for Brazil about 10 years ago, saying, this is Jetinho Brasileiro. This is the Brazilian way. You know, what do you expect them to be, perfect gentlemen? You know, it's all about going out there and tricking your opponent, deceiving your opponent, getting the better of him. And if you trick the referee, then all the better. So, and then, you know, the first group of people retort, well, you're just the kind of people who cheats on your taxes. You're the reason that this country is on its knees. Jetinho Brasileiro, if it wasn't for that, you know, this country would be in a much better place, and so on and so forth. So Neymar kind of setting off a few debates there. I have to say, I mean, he is entertaining. I cannot take that away from him.
All right, we'll be keeping an eye on him. Ken Early reporting from Moscow, where the final score was Uruguay 3, Russia 0, both teams moving on. Ken, thank you, as always, for coming on the show. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Before we get to our baseball conversation with Ben Lindbergh of The Ringer, I wanted to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, another of our guests today, Jay Caspian Kang, will be here, and we'll talk to him about how to choose a baseball team for your child, maybe a football team or a basketball team too. But what are the principles behind selecting a sports team for a human who is barely sentient? If you want to hear that conversation, you should join Slate Plus for just $35 for the first year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangupplus.
Whether pitchers should hit is not a new conversation in Major League Baseball. It's been taking place for more than a century. In fact, our friend Ben Lindbergh traces that history and lays out the latest case for why it's finally time to 86 pitchers hitting in a piece that he wrote for The Ringer. He is here now. Hey, Ben.
Hey, yeah, I made great use of your favorite website and mine, newspapers.com, to dig up old examples of people complaining about the DH, which go back to the 19th century or so.
I was going to ask you where you got those excellent quotes, and the quotes really are excellent. I think this is like legit death watch time for the DH, but not because baseball officials agree that this is a stupid anachronism with dwindling aesthetic or strategic charm. Before we get to the real reasons, let us discuss your argument for going full designated hitter. It's basically that pitchers are at historically bad levels of hitting.
Yeah, it's the same argument as always, really. Pitchers are really bad at this, except that they are worse at this now than they've ever been. And if we do the current checkup on pitcher offensive stats, they are batting 109 with a 141 on base percentage and a 138 slugging percentage. That is truly terrible. They're striking out about 43% of the time. And often the best outcome when a pitcher comes to the plate is that he lays down a sacrifice bunt, which is, I think, kind of a boring play and also a play that has largely been eradicated when a pitcher is not hitting. So that's kind of the best outcome. So that's really it. Pitchers are really bad at this. And I am in favor of a certain level of whimsy in sports, as I know that you guys are as well. So I like watching position players pitch every now and then, but I wouldn't like it if they did it every game. And that's where we are with pitcher sitting. It happens too often to appreciate it.
So baseball in the last like decade or so, there's just been a like very pleasing kind of embrace of new strategies, whether it's the shift or this year we've seen relief pitchers starting games, which, you know, whatever you think of it, it's like interesting. It's like smart. It's like coaches and teams are like willing to like think and try new things.
And it also feels whimsical.
It does feel whimsical. But is this a case where there's been a calculus of like every club that like, we are just not going to care about this because it's not worth it? Like, wouldn't there be some sort of like arbitrage opportunity for a National League team to like really invest in turning this slot in the lineup into like, you know, a plus rather than this like gigantic gaping hole.
Yeah, I'm sure if you really devoted yourself to it, maybe you could get some kind of edge there. There's a Hall of Fame manager back from the 30s, 40s, 50s, Bucky Harris, who really made it a point of emphasis everywhere he went that his pitchers would hit. And they did. Everywhere he went, his pitchers got a bit better, and that was something of an edge for his teams. But these days, it's just so hard to do, and pitchers often aren't hitting on their way up.
It's just so hard to do.
Middle school, they're not hitting. Specialization has rendered pitchers hitting completely obsolete for kids.
Did you guys see in the college baseball regionals, LSU had this pitcher, Todd Peterson, and they had used like a bunch of their bench, and this guy had never hit in college. He was a reliever, and the manager asked him, like, can you hit at all? And he said, I used to like hit bombs in high school. He goes out, he like clears the bases with a double off the wall. LSU wins the game. After the game, he admits he had like actually never hit before. Like his manager had never let him swing a bat, and he was just lying. But it was like the greatest moment of the season. Whimsy. Yeah. It's like there's like a 1% chance, but it paid off.
That is one of the arguments that people make in favor of pitcher hitting, is that the rarer it gets that they do anything useful at all, the more special it seems when they do.
Yeah, Bartolo Colon home run, my friend.
Right, exactly. Right. Maybe that one home run makes up for all of the outs and failed bunt attempts and strikeouts. If that's your perspective, I can't disagree with you. It's a matter of taste. But by the time these guys get to the major leagues, they're not hitting in many cases all the way up. So the Giants have this starter named Andrew Suarez, who's been hitting. Now, he didn't hit in high school. Guys don't hit in college. They don't hit in the low minors.
T-ball?
So they get to possibly T-ball, but I'm not sure that those skills transfer. And I got a lot of people in response to my article saying, well, why don't they just work on it? If they just dedicated themselves to this, they would get better. But we now have about 150 years of history saying they're not going to get better. And I'm comfortable saying that's not a small sample. And these guys are not selected for their hitting ability at all. They're selected for their ability to throw really hard and throw a lot of pitches and throw the pitches where they want them to go. And hitting is just an entirely separate skill. So people say, well, you have to be an all-around player. You have to do everything. But we don't really ask hitters to pitch. And pitchers field their position, right? Isn't that enough?
But when hitters pitch, it's awesome.
It is whimsical and awesome when they do pitch. There's no reason to keep letting them hit. But anyway, let us move on to the actual reasons. And the actual reasons that I think that pitchers are not going to be hitting in 2 or 5 or 10 years is that baseball is heading for a radical realignment.
Radical.
Radical. The reason it's going to happen is because Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, and owners are talking about moving toward expansion and realignment. And in doing that, one of the things that's being discussed is abolishing the American and National Leagues, merging the two leagues basically to create geographically based divisions, probably 8 divisions of 4 teams. And in doing so, the DH rule is just going to go out the window.
This reminds me of back when I was doing my End of America, like hypothetical series back in the day, like 10 years ago or however long ago it was, that there was this conspiracy theory that North America was all going to merge together and that there was going to be a currency called the Amero, and there would not be like... This was like the next step after NAFTA, that we would just all be like one government. So basically, you're just feeding into conspiracy here, Stefan, with like no American National League. We're all just going to use one set of rules. And, you know, the only way to go to a baseball game, Ben, is to like pay with the Amero. Like that's going to be it.
And I'm totally fine with that. And I think you are too, Ben.
Yeah, well, the End of America scenarios were so sweet and innocent 10 years ago. Now they're much darker. Yeah, I think that this is probably coming because, as you say, the incentives are aligned for everyone to want this, because the owners want the expansion fees, which would be hundreds of millions of dollars per franchise. The players want more roster spots, more MLB players, essentially. So I think it is going to happen. And you can imagine in a sport that sees so much uproar, where you have this debate about the DH that's been raging for 45 years unabated here, even as both leagues have kind of coexisted peacefully. Between that and, you know, people getting mad about intentional balls becoming automatic, I mean, that's a major issue in baseball. So you can imagine eradicating the leagues would be an even bigger one. But it does make sense in a lot of ways because the leagues at this point are more of a historical artifact than any real distinction. It's basically just the DH now that is actually separating this from just being an Eastern and Western conference like basketball and football have. So it is kind of archaic, and you could say that there is value to that historical consistency, but I agree. I mean, the teams in both leagues are playing each other throughout the year now. There's constant interleague play. There aren't even two different sets of umpires per league the way that there used to be. There's just really no distinction other than the DH, and so if you want the optimal schedule just from a geographic perspective and you want to put the teams that are located close to each other in the same divisions, then it probably makes sense to do away with the league distinction. And a lot of people are going to be mad about that.
One could argue that baseball itself is a historical artifact, Ben. I mean, I wouldn't dare say that, especially in front of you. But like, this often gets like dumped into the category of like, you know, quote unquote traditionalists, or what's the word? There's a word here. The
purists.
Purists. Right. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about purists as much as we used to. Where's Bob Costas stumping for the purists? But like, that's like the rubric that all of this stuff gets dumped into. And I'm curious if you feel like that's a fair characterization of any of the stuff we've been talking about, the DH or league structure, or, you know, the one that gets talked about a lot that I think people are generally more opposed to is the like extra inning shenanigans and like putting ghost runners on the bases, like starting in the 12th inning or whatever. Like what would you call purity and what would you call just like logic?
So when we talk about this, particularly with the DH and pitcher hitting, you have to adopt this almost paternalistic tone and say that, well, we know better. We know what the better brand of baseball is. And NL fans think pitcher hitting is great, but they just don't know what's good for them. And there's an argument that I think if the NL likes pitcher hitting and the AL likes DH, then maybe we should just keep it status quo. Everyone's happy. Why force someone to change if they don't think it's a problem? So I'm somewhat sympathetic to that, as well as to the strategy arguments that maybe having a pitcher hit, you have to avoid that lineup slot because it's an automatic out. And so you have to do some lineup shenanigans to get around it. I get it. And I think there is some value to historical consistency in a sport that has a really long history. That's one of the things that baseball has going for it, is that it's been around forever and you can compare across eras. And so I am somewhat sympathetic to it, but I do think the game has to change in some ways. And we inherit these old structures that came around in the 19th century or early in the 20th century. And in some cases, there's no good reason to keep things that way other than that's the way they were always done before.
Though I do like players leaving their gloves on the field. I think we should bring that back. That would be fun. If we look at one of the other historical artifacts and something that traditionalists may oppose would be shortening the season, the regular season, and going to 154-game schedule, which baseball's strategic planning committee also has been discussing. Rob Manfred discussed this in an interview with Ken Rosenthal of The Athletic last month. And he seemed pretty sympathetic to the idea that you can make up these lost games and have a better balanced schedule as you add more teams and add playoffs.
Yeah, there's been some discussion of a 154-game schedule, which in a way is more pure than the 162-game schedule because that's what we had from about 1904 to 1960 or so. And the baseball season is just so long. And there are a number of ways in which I think that hurts baseball. And I know a lot of fans think that it's great that baseball is always on. It's kind of the soundtrack to your summer. Whatever the day, there's always baseball on. And that is, I think, a plus for the the sport, but it makes it difficult to feel like any one game matters when there are so many games. And obviously, the owners aren't going to want to sacrifice games if it means less revenue. But in this alignment or realignment and expansion scenario, it would probably coincide with more playoffs, maybe more playoff teams and an extra round of playoffs. And so they would make their money up elsewhere.
What do you think of our pal Sam Miller's idea that every team should make the playoffs?
I kind of liked it, actually. It's kind of compelling. I think that is something that we're going to see with expansion, is that you're going to have more playoff teams. I know that one of the scenarios is that there would just be four divisions in each league, if there are leagues anymore. And so you just have a division winner of each of those leagues. And
where we're going, we don't need leagues.
Right. So I think you're going to see more playoff teams because I think it's lucrative. And also the league likes getting people interested in their teams winning divisions, making the playoffs, which is something that is particularly important given that MLB is actually suffering some attendance issues right now. Even as we're talking about adding teams, there is a kind of side conversation about why teams aren't drawing better this year.
Maybe we should get rid of teams and add teams. That would solve everything. Just end up back in the same place. What is your take on why attendance is down?
And attendance, I should say, is down not a little bit. I mean, the last couple of years, it's dropped like a 1%, but this year it's been off like 6 or 7%.
It's rained a lot is one.
That's Rob reason. Manfred's explanation.
You don't think it's rained a lot?
Well, it has rained a lot, but that's his complete explanation. But I think there's also some evidence that even factoring out those rain dates, attendance is down.
It's down about 5.5% compared to last year, so that gap is narrowing. I'd like to see where it ends this season. It might be closer than it is now. It does have something to do with just a record-setting number of rainouts and snowouts and freezing cold games in April, but even after that, there has been an attendance decline, and so there's a lot of talk about whether it's pace of play or whether it's strikeouts. I tend not to think that it's anything about the style of the game. If anything, I think you look at the markets and the teams that have seen the largest declines, and they're not really surprises. It's the Blue Jays, it's the Marlins, it's the Orioles, the Tigers, the Royals, the Pirates, the Rangers, the White Sox, the Reds. These are all teams that are losing, and perhaps more important, teams that didn't really make an attempt to win this past offseason. They didn't really do anything to get their fans excited, and at the same time, league-wide ticket prices are up, so they're not really offering a discount to see these subpar products. So I think that's part of it.
I'm looking forward to expansion. I really hope Portland gets a team. Who do you like? Portland?
Yeah,
Charlotte,
Portland,
Montreal, Nashville. Mexico City,
yeah.
Nashville. There's some good markets out there.
There are.
There's always this presumption that baseball shouldn't expand further, but I think that in some of these more densely populated markets that weren't densely populated 20 or 30 years ago, and a more sensible approach to stadium construction, you know, more around the 35,000 seat mark.
Expansion is so dumb, but continue.
I disagree.
You're just like imagining a world that doesn't exist. Like, oh, we're going to build like totally sensible stadiums and not soak the public. Like that's ever happened.
No, we're still going to soak the public. Like, I mean, that creep is part of it. But
yeah, I mean, that's kind of a huge part of it, right? Like there's no way that baseball could expand and that it would like be good for those cities. Like that seems like it has to be a pretty major consideration, no?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, as Manfred has said, we need to figure out what to do about terrible markets like Tampa Bay and Oakland. So how do we soak the public to get new stadiums built for them before we can soak the public to expand to other cities?
Right. And they can't expand until they figure out what's going on in Tampa Bay and Oakland, because they have to preserve the specter of moving those teams in order to extract local funding for those ballparks, most likely. So those situations will have to be resolved before that leverage gets removed.
Yeah. And if there are more teams, that would mean that there are going to be more bad teams every year. I mean, I guess you could address that by you know, having more playoff teams, as we've discussed, but this seems like it would line owners' pockets effectively, but I don't know if it would solve any of the fundamental issues that we've been talking about. It would probably exacerbate some of them.
Not if pitchers don't have to hit. Everything will be solved.
I'm glad to hear that.
Ben Lindbergh writes for The Ringer. He's the co-author with Sam Miller of The Only Rule Is It Has to Work. Ben, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. This has been very blasphemous and impure and non-traditional. I've enjoyed it.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
With the number one overall pick in the 1947 Basketball Association of America draft, the Pittsburgh Ironmen selected Clifton McNeely out of Texas Western University. 71 years later, the Phoenix Suns took DeAndre Ayton, who will hopefully earn more cash in his pro career than the alleged $100,000 he got to allegedly commit to the University of Arizona, allegedly. But back to the draft, let's now imagine a world in which we did things differently, in which the worst teams weren't rewarded for their badness by getting allocated the best talent, and in which the world's best pre-professional athletes had some agency in choosing where they live and where they work. Joining us now to discuss this fantasy world is Jay Caspian Kang, who's a correspondent for HBO's Vice News Tonight. He's a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine and the co-host of Coin Talk, a podcast about internet money. How's it going, Jay?
Good. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing well. I'm going to start, as all good podcast segments start, by asking you to recite a Twitter thread that you wrote. You kind of laid out your version of how a non-draft NBA would function. Can you just kind of lay that out for us now?
Well, yeah. I mean, I started thinking about this about 4 years ago when the last collective bargaining agreement started to really bother me. And this was between the league and the players union. And I was trying to figure out why we had the NBA draft at all. And so I was thinking that what would be preferable to it, I mean, both in terms of labor, you know, in terms of being fair to players, but also in terms of entertainment, would be if there was some sort of set free agency period for all players who wanted to enter the NBA. So whether they be high school players, I mean, you could even be like a junior in high school if, you know, under my ideal system, European players, and that the teams would have to bid on the players during this period. All the bids would be public because, you know, the fans like to follow sort of the intrigue of it.
Sure.
And that the player ultimately would have the power to decide whether or not they wanted to go to a team.
The reality is that this existed before the intrusion of the draft and the intrusion of ownership trying to find ways to restrain trade. I mean, the first draft, I think, was the NFL, and it was explicitly stated as a method of controlling payroll and reducing the power and the success of the bigger franchises in the league. So leagues have for decades argued that drafts are a way to promote competitive balance and a way to keep the biggest markets from gaining an unfair advantage. And of course, that's, you know, there's an illogic to it too. It doesn't really work that way. And the only reason leagues get away with this legally is because that they have basically antitrust exemptions on for labor. So these drafts are governed by collective bargaining agreements. And if unions were to say, we think the draft is an anachronism and it does a disservice to not only incoming players, but to other players, then that would be the only way to go about abolishing.
Well, it depends on what you mean by illogic, right? From the league's perspective, it's totally logical.
Oh, sure.
It's a way, as you said, to restrain salaries. It's a way to distribute talent evenly if the league sees itself as a single entity and its collective health is important. It's a way to ensure the teams that finish at the bottom of the standings don't finish on the bottom forever. And sort of as you mentioned, Jay, like there's a whole kind of spectacle and a whole like kind of media ecosystem around the draft too. And in your version, you tried to create something that would mimic that. But just like, you know, honestly, that is a big reason. Like the NFL draft is probably the biggest one. But if we were to come up with a hypothetical, that would potentially be a challenge to come up with a non-draft system that would get people like as hype as the drafts do.
Well, I actually think that people would be more interested in this system after a couple of years. I do think that there is something about the fact that you know what the order is beforehand that makes the draft kind of sequential and logical in the way that people will write about it. So if you know that the Suns are picking first, you can be like, well, the Suns need this, this, and this. But I don't know if that's necessarily true. I don't know if that would necessarily go away under a system of free agency, because I think that, and I actually think that it would be more interesting for the way in which a lot of people, especially draft heads, because, you know, it's not like your casual fan is reading every single draft thing. Like this is a sort of passionate group that knows a lot about basketball. And I mean, I just think that, like, let's say when Anthony Davis came into the NBA draft and everybody was sort of agreed that Anthony Davis was the best talent, perhaps since LeBron, that had come in, you know, it's actually more fun, at least I think, to sort of be like, well, actually, what is his value at the age of 18, you know? And then a couple of years later, when Anthony Bennett, who nobody thought should have been the number one pick in a draft where everybody thought that, you know, those players, the top five players probably would have been picked in the teens, during Anthony Davis's draft, you know, I think that would sort of be a different type of number. And so each draft would have a different, almost like a different valuation cumulatively. I think that would be kind of fun to figure out. And I guess I just don't see where the analysis of players would break down, where it would be less engaging than it is now under a system of free agency.
Yeah, I think the only thing that would be missing would be sort of the dramatic element, like people on a stage surprising you. And I guess the surprise
Can we all wear suits still? That's
yeah, the caps? What about the caps, Jay?
And the hugs and the dap.
Well, and the dap, the, yeah.
The hugs and everything are great, but I think that somebody suggested this on Twitter, and I don't remember the name, but I thought it was pretty funny, which was that, like, basically you have a draft itself in which everybody has to make their final decisions and final bids have to come in. And that, you know, it's sort of like when I don't like these types of ceremonies. And so, but I think it's a little bit better when the person is going and making a lot of money. But, you know, when high school kids commit to a school and they have like five hats, you know, on the table in front
the
of them.
Dance.
Yeah. You could do stuff like that, I think. You could, I don't know how this works with the access that the NBA would be given, but obviously this is all fantasy. So, like, you know, you could even have like cameras inside of the war rooms as people put in, you know, competing bids, and they're like, oh my god, Phoenix went up to 19 million.
Yeah, so it's like a giant, you know, fantasy draft. You do it as a fantasy auction.
Yeah. And I actually think that would probably translate better to the fan base, because that is certainly something that they are familiar with, you know, then it would make the league a little bit more less opaque.
Well, the NBA wouldn't be the NBA wouldn't be the first league to try this in the United States. It would be, but there's a cricket league that started a few years ago in India. The highest the sort of super league for cricket does an annual auction to redistribute talent every year, and seems to work there. I mean, really, this is about changing tradition and about the law and collective bargaining, and you know. The getting back to the illogic question, Jay, I mean, I remember at the dawn of free agency in baseball in the 70s and early 80s, you know, Charlie Finley, the manager, the owner of the Oakland Athletics, was the most sort of outspoken and on the fringe owner. And when the owners and Marvin Miller were fighting about sort of terms of free agency, Finley's suggestion was make them all free agents. And he didn't say it in jest. He said it because he understood that the market actually works to redistribute talent. And that's what we'd be talking about here, finding a more efficient way to redistribute talent. But I do think that the league would have legitimate concerns to ensure that, you'd have to still work within the framework of these giant salary caps so that the Warriors couldn't sign Luka Doncic or whoever.
So there's two versions of it. The first would be within the current salary cap, and that makes it easier for a parity argument to make sense, right? So the Warriors, I'm sure the Warriors have more money than, say, the Atlanta Hawks right now. And so if the Warriors wanted to pay $20 million to Luka Doncic, which I bet he could probably, I bet he could get 15 right now, you know, like a 15 four-year contract. Ayton could probably get somewhere around 20. You don't want him to just go to the Warriors, but if you have a salary cap, then the Warriors can't spend that anyway, right? Because they're capped out, and it rewards teams for saving money and being like, oh, in 3 years, this guy is going to be in the draft and we want to spend all our money on him mm-hmm. as a young kid. But the reason why I initially made this argument, in 2014, I think, was because I thought it was a good, compelling reason to get rid of the salary cap. And I had a hard time believing at that time, given that the NBA had just signed its huge TV rights deal and all the franchise valuations were skyrocketing, that most teams couldn't afford a much larger payroll, you know? And so I didn't quite believe that somebody like the Washington Wizards, who if they feel like they're one player away and that player happens to be Marvin Bagley or DeAndre Ayton, that they wouldn't just pony up and pay that, you know? I also felt like it would be funny in some sort of way for, you know, a team like the Kings, who, you know, their owner is wealthy as well. You know, what if he paid $45 million for DeAndre Ayton because he thought that DeAndre Ayton, under like a 10-year contract or something like mm-hmm. that, because he felt like DeAndre Ayton was that valuable to his franchise. I don't know. I think that to me, at least in terms of a market idea, is more interesting. And if you can't afford to be an NBA owner under that, then there are plenty of people, including Larry Ellison and some of the richest people in the world, who will take your spot.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a logic to what you're saying. If you're going to blow it up, you might as well blow the whole thing up. But I think there's no particular reason why you would have to connect draft, killing the draft with killing the salary cap. And I think, you know, another point that I would make is that if you look back to baseball.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, yeah.
Before baseball instituted the amateur draft, all of the talent really went to the Yankees and maybe a couple other teams. But, you know, the Cardinals had a robust mm-hmm. minor league system, the Dodgers as well. And I think that what you might see here is that, you know, while it sounds well and good that the Hornets and the Kings could outbid everyone, you know, especially if we're imagining a universe in which there's still a salary cap, you know, these players aren't stupid. Like, they understand the value to their like careers and to their brands to go to the Warriors or go to the Celtics or, you know, God forbid the Knicks the Lakers or whoever. I'm not sure that this would give or the Hornets or franchises that are not doing well or that are not well run, I think they might actually be worse off.
Right,
and
that's the risk, right? The risk is that...
Well, it's not really a risk to fans. It's a risk to the league.
It's a
risk to the local fans.
Well, it's also a risk to this notional idea of competitive balance, that if this doesn't do something to help redistribute talent, then that's probably not a good thing for the league. I mean, look at baseball. The current structure for signing international players is very similar to an auction. Teams have an allocation every year with which they can spend on whatever international players they want. There's no draft. It's still an open market. It's less open than it used to be, where the Yankees did go out and sign whatever Japanese or Dominican, you know, player that was hot that year. Not necessarily just the Yankees, but there were other powerful teams that had a lot of money. But this has helped to sort of create a better, more equitable way of signing international talent. I think the difference with the NBA is that these players are already brands. They're already known commodities. They're not 16 years old. So, you know, you'd have to build in some mechanism. And maybe it is through the salary cap, like you said, Jay. I mean, maybe there is some sort of system in place that does acknowledge placement the previous season in terms of bidding.
Well, my final point would be that from a union perspective, I think this would be a hard sell, especially if you're imagining like an uncapped world, because like people got so pissed off with like Glenn Robinson, who was a really good player as the number one pick, getting a huge amount of guaranteed money before he'd even been in the league. Like, I just have a hard time imagining.
The NFL restrained that in terms of what the top picks could
be. Yeah, and the NBA did too. Yeah. But I just have a hard time imagining union members, you know, the NBA Players Association signing on to a deal that would like advantage guys who were not yet in the union.
Right. Well, that's probably why it can't be a totally open, spend whatever you want market. I mean, leagues have done everything in their power to restrain the amount of money that incoming players can receive so as not to disadvantage either middle tier players or even players on a higher end.
Yeah. When I wrote this thing for the first time, years back, the NBA reached out to me and, I've written about this twice now, and both times the NBA has gotten kind of mad about it, and I don't know why. And I certainly am not at a status in the basketball world or even as a writer in general where anybody should be worried about what I'm writing. But their argument was that it would disadvantage mid-tier veterans, which is somebody making $8 million a year is going to be harmed by it, which is why I was essentially saying the best version of this was where the mid-tier veteran could make their money and the rookie could make their money in an uncapped system, because I think that would get around some of the problems that would come up. As for a competitive balance imbalance, like, I do understand what you're saying, but I think that right now, if you look at some of the superstars in the league, it's not like when they were coming into the draft that these people would all be given $20 million contracts. Porzingis, for example, Giannis, I think all these guys probably would have been signed to very favorable contracts. I don't know if anybody, even under an uncapped system, would be giving Giannis, who I think was a 15th pick or something like that they would be giving him $20 million a year. Most likely, he'd probably be getting about what he got for his rookie contract. Obviously, the top talents would still be getting a lot of money, but it wouldn't be tiered towards what year they happen to enter the draft. It would just be tiered towards whatever their talent was coming in, which I actually think is probably a better system.
The one thing we haven't touched on here is that the biggest criticism of the draft in recent years has, of course, been tanking. And there have been other proposals to remedy the draft. There was the wheel proposal where teams would get to draft in each slot every 30 years on a straight rotation basis. This would help eliminate tanking, would seem to me. Is that part of the impetus, Jay?
Yeah. I mean, I don't have a moral problem with tanking, but I don't like it. I don't like the fact that so many games are irrelevant. I remember the Warriors when they were trying to get Harrison Barnes, starting five centers. And I was like, it is kind of embarrassing for the league. I think that's why the league really wants to solve tanking, because it sort of, nobody really wants to watch these teams play. This completely takes away any incentive for tanking. I mean, the only reason teams tank is to get more lottery balls in the lottery. There's no lottery. They're not going to do that anymore. And if they can just spend their cap space, then there's no real reason to tank. I think that actually makes player development a lot easier, because the guys are in competitive environments all the time. And I think I would just say the number one reason would be don't you want to get rid of tanking? The wheel system to me is crazy. I didn't quite understand how that would even work. This is a much more simple, elegant solution, I think.
Well, and the other part of the solution here, Jay, is that it would encourage teams to do everything in their power to be attractive to incoming players as well as free agents. Do better, and then you will get better players.
Do better.
Exactly.
That could be the motto.
I mean, it's not just like these sorts of PowerPoint presentations that they put together or these dinners that they have for the players that are coming in. I mean, I think that ownership should be more incentivized to try and get young talent to come there. I mean, it's like almost any other business.
How quickly could you change a culture by having a great player come in? Quickly.
Yeah, and how much fan interest could you generate? It really, what is that worth to you? Those are all the types of decisions that every single other business has to make. I don't understand why NBA teams don't have to make that type of decision because of the draft.
I think for me, the strongest argument here. I mean, I'm all for the players being able to choose wherever they go, but for me, I'm delighted with the idea that bad owners would get punished, because yeah. the reason that owners in all leagues want this system is because there's no way for them to fail. And like, that's why all these leagues have, you know, revenue sharing. There's like right. no way as a sports owner to fail. Everyone, and this would be a way for owners to fail.
Every one of these restrictions that's been placed on payroll and salary and bidding for athletes over the last 40 years has been done to save owners from themselves.
Yep.
And that's over now in Jay's world.
We're blowing it up.
Jay Caspian Kang is a correspondent for HBO's Vice News Tonight. He writes for the New York Times Magazine, and he's the co-host of the podcast Coin Talk. Jay, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Now it is time for After Balls. In the intro for the draft segment, I mentioned the 1947 BAA draft. The BAA would merge with the NBL a few years later to form the NBA. Anyhow, the fourth pick in that BAA draft was Walt Drapeau, who at the time was UConn's all-time leading scorer in men's basketball, but would never play in the pros because he was busy playing Major League Baseball for 13 years. But don't forget the number two pick, Stefan.
Glenn Selbo.
Glenn Selbo.
Yeah, of course.
He was taken by the
Toronto Huskies. Come on.
Who folded before his career started, so he ended up playing for
another team.
Oshkosh and Sheboygan of the NBL powerhouses. Mm-hmm. But hold on, Stefan. Glenn Selbo also played minor league baseball in Grand Forks, North Dakota, Quincy, Illinois, La Mesa, Texas, and Midland, Texas. So take that, Walt Drapeau, basketball and baseball in the pros. How do you like take that, Walt Drapeau, as a remember Zelmo Beatty-esque catchphrase?
I don't know. I think the Drapeau. I think it's Drapeau.
Is it Drapeau?
I think it might be Walt Drapeau. I don't know.
Let's just say them both and see which one we like. Take that, Walt Drapeau.
Take that, Walt Drapeau.
I mean, Drapeau definitely sounds better.
Drapeau sounds better. So if the Drapeau family is listening, consider going with Drapeau.
All right. Let's stick with Selbo.
316 batting average and a .454 slugging percentage never made in the minors.
Major, never made the majors. Something is afoot. I blame Drapeau. Stefan, what is your Glenn Selbo?
England fans, of course, will recall that at the 1990 World Cup in Italy, the Three Lions were eliminated in the semifinals by Germany on penalty kicks. Sometime after that game, England striker Gary Lineker is said to have said this: "Football is a simple game. 22 men chase a ball for 90 minutes, and at the end, the Germans win." Lineker is now a popular television commentator with a Twitter feed that's worth following. Over the weekend, on that Twitter feed, he shat on Piers Morgan, who was getting into a shouting match with him for some reason, as Lineker once did on the field, literally. He fell ill during a game in that 1990 World Cup. He also dusted off his famous line after Germany's last seconds win over Sweden. Lineker wrote, "Football is a simple game. 22 men chase the ball for 82 minutes and the Germans get a player sent off. So 21 men chase the ball for 13 minutes. And at the end, the Germans somehow fucking win." Lineker has been dining out on "football is a simple game" for years. He wrote another version of it last year after Germany beat England in a friendly. And with good reason. It's a great line. I haven't been able in newspaper databases to find a first use from Lineker. Some writers go with "attributed to Gary Lineker." Lineker himself seems cagey about taking full credit for it. When a follower on Twitter wrote to him, "I trust it is legit," Lineker wrote back, "Ha, But let's assume that Lineker did indeed say it. What he was doing was lamenting and praising the inevitability of Die Mannschaft, while also simultaneously mocking the idea that football is in fact a simple game. Lineker was having a go at old-time coaches who uttered bromides like football is a simple game, which sounds like a deep thought, but actually isn't. The most prominent pre-Lineker utterer of the bromide was Bill Shankly, a Scotsman best known for coaching Liverpool in the 1960s and early 70s. He gets credit for two uses of the line. The first is, football is a simple game based on the giving and taking of passes, of controlling the ball, and of making yourself available to receive a pass. It is terribly simple. And the second is, football is a simple game made complicated by people who should know better. That version of the line, also attributed to Shankly, is sometimes rendered as football is a simple game complicated by idiots. A coach named Graham Taylor said in the early 80s, reflecting English sensibilities at the time, football is a simple game. The man on the terraces is not interested in seeing 15 consecutive passes in his team's half of the field. I hate sophisticated football. This sort of empty-calorie faux wisdom isn't unique to association football. I found football is a simple game referring to American football going back to the 1940s. Football is a simple game effectively played by athletes disciplined to simplicity. Football is a simple game. The team that hits the hardest and puts people on their back more often is going to win. Football is a simple game that is made complicated by coaches. Mitch frigging Albom once used the line. But spinning off of Lineker is the most common way to go. The line itself is often mangled. I found in stories, football is a simple game. It's 11 against 11, and in the end, Germany win. Football is a simple game. A match lasts for 90 minutes, and at the end of it, the Germans win the shootout. Football is a simple game between two teams of 11 men. You play for 120 minutes, and Germany wins on penalties. Some writers have added a round before ball. I need to know it's a round ball. Some add always before win. Germany always win. There are dozens of adaptations on Twitter. Our friend Roger Bennett did it after the U.S. women won the World Cup in 2015. Football is a simple game. 22 women chase a ball for 90 minutes, and at the end, the United States win. I consider that good use. Big moment, nice parallelism, faithful rendering. Manchester City, Iceland, other teams have been subbed in for Germany there, both seriously and ironically. After a Moscow derby last year, a reporter wrote, football is a simple game. 22 men chase a ball around for 90 minutes, and then play is stopped twice because the fans set off fireworks inside the stadium. It's kind of funny. Gaelic football is a simple game. 30 men pass the ball side to side for 70 minutes, and at the end, the hurling comes on. I have no idea what that means, but I'm going to allow it. As for other renderings, not quite as good. Football is a simple game. 22 men chase a ball for 60 minutes, and at the end, the Patriots always win. That was written by CNN's Chris Saliza on Super Bowl Sunday in 2017. It got 1,800 likes, mostly from people who probably didn't understand the reference. I'll assume Saliza didn't piggyback off of ESPN soccer commentator Adrian Healy, who tweeted pretty much the exact same thing 20 minutes earlier. You know, it's possible that he just got it. He knew the phrase. The most appalling use of football as a simple game, though, Josh, goes to this quotation from FIFA magazine in 2014 from our dear friend, Sepp Blatter. Football is a simple game that becomes complicated once you attempt to explain the offside rules to your wife.
You're shitting me.
I am not.
Oh, my God. Sepp never disappoints,
never
does he?
Does. No, he doesn't. Josh, what's your Glenn Selbo?
On Sunday, Panama's men's national soccer team scored its first ever World Cup goal. Panama, the quintessential team that is just happy to be there, Stefan, they celebrated wildly, as did their fans, despite the fact that said goal made the scoreline England 6, Panama 1. As you pause to wonder how Panama made the World Cup and the U.S. didn't, and just a warning that that pause could last up to 4 years, I also want to mention that you should watch the clip of Panama's announcers listening as the nation's anthem played at the World Cup for the first time. Let's just listen to a snippet of that. It was moving. There were hugs. Check it out on Twitter.com. But given that this is Panama's first World Cup, there are a lot of guys who suited up for the national team who never got to hear that anthem on the world's biggest stage. One of them is Luis Moreno. He's the defender, 76 appearances, scored zero goals for Panama between 2001 and 2011. But that's because he was very invested in his defensive responsibilities. So good job, Luis. But Moreno did something that no other player in soccer history has ever done that I am aware of. In February 2011, during a game between Moreno's Colombian club team, Deportivo Pereira, and the club Junior de Barranquilla, the latter's live owl mascot got on the field and was hit by a ball. It was a bad scene. Moreno had a bunch of options here. So what do you do when there's an injured owl on the field? You can cradle the owl in your arms.
Tenderly.
You can wave on some owl-specific medical personnel or just a generalized paramedic-type squad. Or you could do nothing, which is always my preferred option. Instead, what our friend Moreno did was jog over and punt the owl over the touchline with his left foot. I got June Thomas of the Waves podcast, the great and illustrious June Thomas. She's a Spanish speaker. I got her to translate a local news report about the incident for me. And so it begins with the moment when the spectators become angry. The commenter says, "Que feo, how ugly." And then there's a member of the Civil Defense Forces of Colombia who comes on and says the people were so full of indignation that they threw things at Moreno, and kind of rightly so. Then June says that they quote a guy who says, "It's unfair. How can you kick an animal? He's the animal. I can't stand it." Then they quote Moreno, who says, "Actually," and this is a good one for the All-Time Excuse Hall of Fame, "I did it to make it fly. It wasn't my intention to hurt it. It was just an owl helper." And then they quote him as saying, "He's since shown remorse. I'm sorry. It wasn't my intention to do any harm. I apologize to the fans in Barranquilla." The owl was then taken to a veterinary clinic for evaluation. And then you've got, first you have the owl on camera, and it's like, looks incredibly sad in this like little owl box. Then they quote the vet tech saying, "We have to wait and see if it will respond to the medication we gave it to help with the shock." So the owl was in shock. And again, rightly so. The owl got kicked by an asshole, a soccer-playing asshole. So other news reports said that fans at the game were chanting "murderer." The owl was initially assessed as having minor injuries in addition to shock, but it would later die. And the cause of death, they would say, as shock, that the owl died of shock. The blog South American Football reported that Moreno was getting death threats. He faced up to 3 months in jail. In the end, he got a 2-match ban, a $560 fine, and he was ordered to do community service at a zoo. Although I have not been able to find whether he was detailed to like some sort of owl area or if they kept him as far away from owls as possible. Stefan, you might recall various accidental bird killing incidents in baseball, the emphasis on accidental. Yeah. Randy Johnson threw a fastball that made a dove explode in 2001. There's also Dave Winfield. I'm surprised you didn't go to Winfield first. 83, throwing a ball from the outfield, killed a seagull. Mm-hmm. But there was also, and I didn't know about this until I was doing my bird killing research, a more malicious event that happened 15 years ago. The Chicago Tribune's headline from July 14th, 2003, "Cubs prospect struggles to shake bird killer label." In that piece, Charles Robinson described how minor leaguer Jae Kook Ryu, then a 19-year-old, he was from South Korea, eyed an osprey on a utility pole and just started winging baseballs at it. And he eventually struck the bird in the head. The osprey was known as Ozzy, like also like this owl from Colombia.
The owl had a name too?
Yeah. I wasn't able to find a name for the owl, but it was like a known owl. It was an owl that hung out. Ozzy the osprey was like, well, ospreys are like rare birds. Like when there's an osprey around, you kind of know that there's an osprey around. And so fans at this like Daytona Beach ballpark, they were like knew this osprey. They were into Ozzy the osprey. So this was like not a cool thing to do, obviously. And the osprey, like the owl, would die 6 days later. He did an interview with Charles Robinson. This is through an interpreter. He was quoted as saying, "I want people to know me inside, not just the outside. I want everyone to know I'm not a bad person. There were some difficult things after the bird was hit, but in my mind, I did something wrong. I feel bad. I want to get over it, but it takes time. I know that. I just want to gain the trust of fans again." Rio was immediately demoted. They got him out of Daytona. They sent him to the Cubs affiliate in Lansing, Michigan. He was charged with a misdemeanor. I haven't been able to find how the case was adjudicated, but he eventually made it to the majors. He put up a 1-3 career record with a 7.49 ERA. He now plays in Korea for the LG Twins and is hopefully no longer an enormous bird-killing jerk. Stefan, take that, Walt Drapo. That is our show for today. There's no evidence that Walt Drapo ever did.
It was really just an early instance of VAR, veterinary-assisted refly. Does that make any sense?
That makes no sense. I appreciate the effort. Yeah. I wanted to say that our producer is Patrick Fort, and our intern is Meredith Allison. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.
Guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.